In the time today, Philip Dunford, or Phil Dunford, the Vice President and General Manager of Boeing Rotorcraft Systems, is going to share some information with you about the portfolio of Boeing Rotorcraft products, and then I think Phil's keen to lead a bit of a discussion, perhaps a extended Q&A session with you about what happens next beyond the current evolution of Boeing rotorcraft technology and industry rotorcraft technology. So without any further ado, we'll hold questions until after Phil's finished his presentation, but certainly then we'll get right into the questions and answers. So go ahead, Phil.
Okay, thanks. Hi, everybody. How are you? Everybody warm enough? Before I get on to our current products, I'd like to make a point about this slide that we don't often make a point about anymore. If you see the middle picture on there, it's the CH-46, the Sea Knight that the Marines flying. They're still flying about 150 of those airplanes, and they're doing a tremendous job. And I got to tell you, the reliability and availability of that aircraft is as high as any of the newer aircraft in not just the Marine inventory, but in the Army inventory in Afghanistan or Iraq. So I just wanted to point that out. We don't often talk about the 46, but it's an older one of our products, but just really going well. What I'm going to focus on is some of the programs that still have some life in them, because the 46 is actually fading away slowly. The V-22, as you know, is taking it over. I think I have control here. So this is our portfolio right now. Very strong portfolio, the backbone of it probably being the Chinook and the Apache, but the V-22 growing very significantly as we speak. And I'll talk in detail about each one of these as we go forward. A little bit about the rotorcraft organization, and some of you have heard this before, so I apologize for those that you have, but just a little bit of background. We have two plants, one in Mesa and one in Philadelphia. The Mesa plant is where we build the Apache helicopter. In Philadelphia, on the east coast of the states, we build the Chinook and the V-22. Both of those plants roughly have about 4,000 employees, and the whole rotorcraft is about 8,500 employees, even though at both sites we actually have other Boeing employees on those sites, to total about 10,500 right now. At both sites we have a pretty good backlog, and I'll talk about that when I get to the program some. And from a market position, we're strong too. From a military perspective, very strong, particularly in the heavy lift side of things and certainly in the attack side of things. We have about 28.5% of the worldwide market share in total, which includes the commercial, if you add those in as well. And obviously, that with everything that's going on in the world today, not just from a military perspective, but also from a humanitarian perspective, I think it's true to say that military rotorcraft market is projected to remain very strong. And from our perspective, that's obviously very good, because I think we have some excellent products that can help the world in those areas. From a strategy perspective, where do we go from here? And I'll talk a little bit more about the details behind our strategy later on. But the key is obviously to extend our current products. One of the things you'll see when you look at the U.S. Army or the DOD inventory, as you look out to the past 2018, there aren't too many new products coming along yet. So our goal is to try and seed that industry just a little bit. So extending our products in from a Chinook perspective, from a V-22 and an Apache perspective, is very important to us. At the same time, looking to what we will do in the future in terms of where the Army is going, and particularly the Marine Corps and Navy. So let's talk about the Apache just for a minute. Built as a recon and attack aircraft, everybody that uses would probably agree with you that this is a premier multi-role helicopter in the world. It was designed for work in the folder gap. And I don't know what the equivalent of this expression is worldwide, even though Damien tells me never to use it, but we call it the quarterback of the battlefield. So on a soccer field, that might be the captain. What other sports are that you could relate that to, I don't know. But it does, from a perspective of its use in terms of support of the battlefield, we call it the quarterback of the battlefield. And in terms of the number of hours that this airplane has flown, It's about 2.5 million cumulative hours now from Block A through Block D. I'll talk to you in a minute about the next version of it that's come along, which is Block 3. It flew over 470,000 hours in Iraq. That was 24 aircraft with a mission capable rate above about 82%. Now, in Afghanistan, there's actually quite a lot more airplanes out there. There's 120 airplanes now, and the mission capable rate is 87%. We have about 11 international customers, and to be honest with you, people are asking us about the Apache all the time, because as I said, I think it is the attack recon helicopter of choice. And then the next part of the program is the Block 3 program. This is an extension of the Block D program. We're in the middle right now of the development phase. We flew the airplane early last year for the first Block 3 aircraft. And you can see some of the things that we've done to enhance the performance of the airplane. I suppose the most significant of those would be from a performance perspective. One of the complaints that we used to get about the Apache was that when it operated in high hot conditions with all the equipment that it had on it, its performance wasn't to the level that the U.S. Army wanted it. So what we've done is we've gone out and upgraded the drive system. We have a new gearbox technology installed in the airplane right now. We've improved the rotor blades. We were actually going to put a new airframe on it, and that's given us a performance level that allows it to fly 6K95, which is the requirement that the Army is expecting us to meet for the Block 3 airplane. The most significant thing, though, I think that we've done is we've improved the network-enabled capability of the airplane. So where it was the quarterback of the battlefield before, now it's going to be tied into everybody. So it can talk to anybody at any time. During a mission. The other thing it can do, it can control UAVs from inside the cockpit, level 4 control. So instead of just an Apache out there, you can have UAVs being controlled from one or two of those Apaches as they go out on a mission. You can see some of the other things in there that I won't get into. Improved fire control radar, quicker target acquisition on that, radio frequency interferometer, which allows us to find air defense targets a little bit more quickly, and then the fire and forget hellfire, just improvements in terms of the weapons systems. And then the IHAD systems that the pilot relies on so significantly, and in the past has maybe added to his workload, has been improved significantly on this airplane. Just a few pieces of data on the number of airplanes that have been produced in the past. The Block 1 and 2 airplanes, 618 of those as of January 2010, and then 52 new build ones as of January 2010. And those will all be turned eventually into 634 Block 3 Apaches. Some of them, in the LRIP aircraft, up to a certain level will actually be remands, and then from there on out there'll be new airframes, and we'll end up with 634 of those for the U.S. Army. And we're now having a lot of interest in that configuration, and even though there are 11 international customers, not all of those have gone to Block 3 yet, but I'm sure as they see the capability, and we've proven the capability after our development testing, we certainly will get there. The 47, what can you say about the CH-47? Tremendous airplane. You know, originally this airplane was put together in its traditional roles for combat support and combat service. You know, it's been there from Vietnam to Iraqi freedom. Significant long-haul load carrier, point-to-point logistics work, combat search and rescue when it's been called upon before. And don't forget, this configuration from a combat search and rescue perspective was the one that won the CSAR program before that was cancelled. And then humanitarian aid obviously is a major part of what this airplane is capable of. Its new roles, however, are more combat focused as well as those. Infiltration and exfiltration, deep combat assaults, and then obviously inside the United States, homeland defense. And its major claim to fame, I think, is its operation at high altitude, and has proven itself in Afghanistan over and over again. And there was a mission, a rescue mission up there at 16,200 feet that we like to brag about. So why the Chinook? What makes it so good? You know, 100% of the power goes to the rotors, so that gives you the lift that you need at high altitude. It's got good blade performance. It's probably the fastest helicopter out there today. I don't think that's a widely known fact, but it is. And then, just because of the tandem configuration, it has improved stability in crosswinds and in water operations. It excels, and it has a very wide CG envelope, which allows it to carry all sorts of different loads inside and outside the airplane. So a great configuration for the type of mission that is expected of it around the world today. The new airplanes that we're working on right now are the F model, which is the U.S. Army is working on, and the G model. We've actually delivered 55 of the 61 of those, and they're used for special operations. And the configuration improvements, particularly on the F, are mainly in the cockpit, where we've installed the CAS cockpit. We've improved the airplane fuselage significantly. It is all now a new fuselage. A lot of the airplanes have recapitalized drive systems and rotors, but later on we'll bring in new configurations of those. And then you can see that there's a lot of improved avionics. And what the most, I think the most significant one of those is the digital AFCS, automatic flight control system, which has had significant impact on the low speed handling qualities of the aircraft and its capability to land in brownout conditions. So here's some numbers for the 47F. The U.S. Program of Record is 452 F models. As I said, you can see the number of renews in there. And now, when we started off this program, we were going to make 55 new builds. We got up to 192 of those right now. 291 of those are on contract in a multi-year. And our first multi-year of those is for 191 airplanes. And then, as I said, the U.S. SOCOM folks have 61 of the airplanes. We anticipate that they will look for a new build airplane in the near future. You know, they've seen what we've done to the F model, and I think as they try and build their capability, they will look to try and take some of the capabilities that we have in the F model and use those as we go forward. V-22 Osprey. I don't know how many of you know, you probably all know, that the airplane is now in Afghanistan and doing very well in Afghanistan. It did well in Iraq. This airplane, five times the range, twice the speed of a helicopter. So if you think about the types of missions it can do and the types of missions it's expected to do in Iraq, it can do things in one period of darkness that other helicopters haven't been done before. And that's the type of feedback we're getting from the desert and from the mountains, that this airplane has the capability to really change the combat out there in terms of what it can provide as support. The other thing is it's self-deployable, and the CV, the special operations folks who have actually been deployed already in Iraq and are now back, in fact they've been deployed in North Africa as well, they've actually taken the airplane out, self-deployed it to Iraq non-stop, 5,000 miles once they took off from CONUS, and they do that on a regular basis, and they found that the airplane has significantly changed their capability. And they're looking to get more of those so that they can enhance their capability further. You can see the types of missions that the V-22 does. I think what we're finding is, as a user finds out what the V-22 really can do, the number of missions that it does gets added to on a regular basis. Just so that you know, if you haven't already been briefed on it, this program, since 1982, has been a 50-50 work split between Bell Helicopter and the Boeing Company. Boeing produces everything that you see there under the wing and the nacelles. So in Philadelphia, what we would produce is the fuselage and the empennage, even though the empennage is, we get that supplied to us from a supplier, but we're responsible for it. So we deliver that fuselage down to the Bell facility in Amarillo, Texas, and they just put the wing and the rotor on the top of it. What we deliver is ready to go fly. So it's been checked out before it leaves the factory, electronically, hydraulically, you name it, we've done it to it. So it's pretty much a plug and play this fuselage into the wing and go deliver it to the customer. Some of the things that we're doing, the tilt rotor technology obviously is a proven technology now. So what we've got to think about for the future is what do we do with that technology to enhance the capability as we go forward. We've done a lot with the composite airframe. To be honest with you, once upon a time it was an old composite airframe, but we found for weight reduction reasons that we needed to make it a hybrid aircraft. So now we have aluminum frames, and probably about 75% of the airplane is composite. Pretty much all of the skins are composite, even though there are a few of those that are aluminum. And then I would argue that the fully digital fly-by-wire flight control system is the reason this airplane exists. It has 26 actuators on it, and I can't imagine that this airplane would work if it was a mechanical control system. So the heart of the airplane to me is first of all the configuration, but the control of that configuration through the fly-by-wire flight control system. And it gives it all sorts of capability, coupled capability and brownout. It gives us load limiting capability, so the pilot can fly the thing without worrying about over speeding or over stressing the aircraft. So from my perspective, a transformational technology that now what we need to do is learn from what we've got in this technology and take it to the next level. In terms of the future of the airplane, the strategy going forward will be to make sure we get the availability to the levels that the customer needs it, to drive the affordability of the product down so that it gets a little bit closer to the cost of a helicopter, to make it more competitive maybe with a helicopter. And once you do that, and I'll talk about that in a minute, it becomes very competitive from a productivity perspective. And then to execute from the standpoint of the production program and the performance-based logistics program that we're just getting into with the Marines and the Air Force. And just a few numbers on this airplane. 458 of them in the program of record. 360 MVs, 50 CVs. And then there is a requirement for 48 Navy airplanes, which I'm not sure will end up being Navy aircraft, but we'll probably get those in some sort of other role. And then there is international interest. There are no international sales yet, but there is international interest in the aircraft. And then our latest addition to the portfolio is the AH-6i. This is a six-bladed rotor system. There is one here. I don't know whether you've all seen it, but there's one out on static display here. So if you haven't seen it, please take the time to go look at it. It's got a state-of-the-art cockpit in it. A lot of that is stuff that we've learned from the AH-64. Some of the displays in the cockpit come from the 64. Some of the software that we use in the airplane is from the 64. It's got a 600 horsepower transmission in it, an 850 horsepower Rolls-Royce engine that's FADEC controlled. Missions are light attack, security and escort, insertion, anti-personnel, recon. Pretty good capability for the size of the airplane, and it takes off at a gross weight of about 47,500 pounds. Here's just a quick look at some of the equipment in it. It's fully integrated weapons system in there. Again, taking lessons that we've learned from the Apache integration. And we do use some of the modified Apache Block 3 software. In fact, the ARH software that we produced was 83% common to the Apache Block 3, and we're trying to import a lot of that into what we're doing here. It has a tremendous growth capability without adding a lot of weight, and this airplane is actually securing some international interest. So those are the products, and what I'd like to talk about a little bit is maybe give you some food for thought and questions, is about where the rotorcraft industry is going. I've got two charts I'd like to show you here before I finish. So if you think about today's business realities, we're kind of in an economic downturn everywhere. At least in the DOD, there is an R&D and an S&T downturn and funding constraints that we're all suffering with right now. Probably every OEM has a cost structure that's too high. We have protracted development in all of the development programs. And I have to say this, by the way. I want to get this one in so that you write it down. The Apache program today is one of the only DOD development programs that is on cost and on schedule. And you don't hear that very often. But it really is, and it's been audited by the customer on a number of times and been held up there as a great example of a development program. And I think the key to it was the fact that we had a really good systems engineering approach to the development program with our customer. It was a joint approach to how we did the systems engineering on the front end of the program with the customer, where everybody understood what the requirements were and how we were going to qualify the airplane and validate those as we went through the SDD process. So if you go look at that left-hand bullet up there, that focused technology improvements and prototypes bullet, what we have out there today is a lot of technical improvements that everybody wants in their airplanes. Advanced materials and systems, open systems architecture. They want the UAVs that we have today flown in the airplanes. Everything needs to be network enabled. And by the way, helicopters can't vibrate like they used to because it drives down the reliability. And then up in the right-hand corner there, we have safety and survivability and reliability improvements to overcome some of the things that we've talked about. So we talk about mission assurance all the time. We talk about developing HUMS type systems for the airplanes. We put ASE equipment into the aircraft to make them more survivable. And then if we get it right, maybe we can increase the speed, because the more speed you have, the more survivable an airplane is. And I would argue that's an advantage that the V-22 has. And then right at the bottom, you have this thing called cost of ownership improvements, because if you don't get the things right up at the top, what you have is an issue with cost, whether it's the acquisition cost, whether it's the development cost, or what it costs you to keep the airplane flying on a regular time frame. What we're looking for in the future, I think, to give our customer what he was looking for, what we would call warfighter productivity, is an order of magnitude change in reliability and getting the speed of helicopters above where we are today. A helicopter is anything between 120 knots and 180, 70. Chinook's 170 if you can get yourself there light enough. What we need is a helicopter that's maybe 200 and can maybe get up to the speeds of a tilt rotor. So, you know, Sikorsky are doing some of that work. I think Eurocopter are doing some of that work. So how do we get there? So you can put the technology in place, but it's more than that. You have to put the reliability into the aircraft. So I would argue that there's a value proposition out there that we need to work on, either collectively or on our own, and it depends on what part of that you're going to be competitive in. So the first thing is, this is a construct for comparing rotorcraft to rotorcraft, and even rotorcraft to other products. Maybe rotorcraft to trucks, because rotorcraft sometimes do the same job as those. So the left-hand side of that chart is what we call the barrier to entry. So any time that you produce a new product or you take an old product to the next level, you extend it, there is some development cost. And invariably, we all run into the issue that development cost is high, whether it's a helicopter program or a fixed-wing program. So that's the thing that the acquisition folks look at and say, well, if I've got to spend all this money, my PGO is going to be something like 0.1. So in our industry, we have to find a way of driving those development costs down so that when the acquisition folks look at it, they say, wow, this is good. The PGO is going to be something like 0.5 or 0.6 or something higher. In the middle is the thing that we all fight over all the time when we go to compete. Payload, radius, speed, and procurement cost. And that is an equation. Payload times radius times speed divided by cost. And those are the things that we have classically competed on. P-win. So if you think about that, that's kind of the cost-benefit analysis that the acquisition folks go through on a regular basis. Those are the things that they look at when they see our proposals. It's focused on acquisition cost. It is, to some degree, focused on development cost, because those two things are kind of tied together. But it's the trade space that our industry works in on a regular basis. And it's, you know, what we play for when we go to compete with all the other OEMs, or we work with other OEMs against other teams, for example. And then on the right-hand side is the thing that maybe we haven't got right yet, and that's this ownership experience, the customer satisfaction of this thing. And this is still all part of the same equation. So when you add all these things together, availability times survivability divided by operating and support costs, you get the type of equation that we probably ought to be working on, both on our own and collectively, to optimize the rotorcraft configuration for the warfighter or anybody else that's going to use a helicopter. And just lately, I have to say, I think we've had a breakthrough in this, in that this time last, well, not this time last year, but last year at the Paris Air Show, we were briefing kind of this concept, and after it, there was a guy called Tony Melita in DOD who picked up on this, and he's been working with industry over the past 6 months to try and work this concept, and he's been very successful. In fact, he retired just last week, but he's been successful in getting industry together with DOD to put together a vertical lifts consortium to go look at what it takes to do this type of thing, and not just this, but technology advancement and how we work between DOD and the industry to improve our industry in terms of the products that we produce for the warfighter in his case. But all this obviously reflects also on the commercial world. So that vertical lift consortium is going to be focused on S&T development, but also roadmap development in terms of where we go next in the industry. And over the next year, the first phase of that is all about roadmap development. And I believe for the first time, industry is going to be working closely with DOD to help develop those roadmaps and work with them on together on what we should do for the future of helicopters. So to me, this is a big breakthrough. And I think the credit needs to go to Tony Melita for pushing this through, and his successor, hopefully, for taking this on and driving industry in the right direction. And finally, an advanced rotorcraft chart that shows all the things that we're working on in our industry now. The sorts of things that we'll be talking about with Tony Melita and his team. Well, not Tony, but his replacement and his team. And I won't go through the details of these. You can see some of the advanced rotorcraft things that we're working. There are some heavy lift options from a tandem and a joint future theater lift tilt rotor that we're working. We actually have some work going on and a proposal for a ship-to-shore connector, which is actually a hovercraft, but with the same type of technology that helicopters have. And then we've talked before about Skyhook. Some platform technologies like gearboxes, and then network applications, that the type of things that go into Apache. And then unmanned or optionally manned aircraft and all the technologies that go into making the product that we need for the future, which has this improved reliability and hopefully speed increase. So, as a division, I think we have a healthy business, good prospects for the future. You know, there's a lot going on in our business right now. A lot of people want the Chinook. A lot of people want the Apache. We need to get into the position where a lot of people want the V-22 and the AH-6. We have a strong market position, like I've said. There is a competitive environment that we have to work in out there. And we are strategy focused, like I've told you, to try and take the rotorcraft organization to the next level. And here and there, we're working with our friends and internationally and domestically in what we call a co-opetition environment. You know, we compete on a regular basis, and we cooperate on a regular basis. And if you remember the chart that I showed you, some of that cooperation is where we need to go for the industry. So that's all I have from a prepared speech perspective. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try and answer them.
Paul Jackson from Show News.
Yes, sir.
The only helicopter that doesn't make sense at the moment is AH-6. Presumably, you're thinking of some big customers to make it worthwhile relaunching production. I know you probably can't tell us where they are, but
you're right.
Can you give us some more hints?
I can't give you any hints, but there are some out there that are very interested in the airplane. You know, we had a lot of customers come to the Dubai Air Show and look at the aircraft, and hopefully we've got the same number coming here. Of course, at the Dubai Air Show, we flew the airplane. But after that air show, we did get a lot of interest in the aircraft. And I really don't want to say who we're talking to.
Are you launching it cold then, or do you have some ideas of your targets already?
We have ideas. Yeah. I mean, when it comes to launching a new product, you're looking for somebody that can help you with that launch. But I think we think the airplane has a significant capability, and it help kind of helps itself. But we'll see. We're going to see in the next year. So.
Hi, John Reed with Defense News. Can you talk a little bit more about the international prospects for the V-22?
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest issue internationally with the V-22 right now is affordability. Yeah, I have a triangle that I work with on a regular basis on the V-22. I think about the V-22 in the future with three things. And I think I mentioned them in the brief. The top of the triangle would be availability. So it's making sure that we get the aircraft where it needs to be in terms of fleet readiness. And that's always important for any helicopter. The V-22 is no different from a tilt rotor perspective. So that's the first thing we need to do. The second one is this affordability perspective. Because, you know, if you drive the affordability of the airplane down, it also helps the availability because the price of all your parts goes down. Everything is kind of connected to each other from an affordability standpoint. So we think we really need to get maybe 15 or 20% out of the price to make it affordable internationally. So we're working hard on that. And then the other one, of course, is execution. We still have a 400 and, I can't remember the number now, 58 aircraft program that we have to execute and now support. So those three things come together. So, you know, internationally, I think people are looking to see what we're doing in order to drive that cost down. There's been a number of countries that have come and talked to us. Again, I can't list those. I don't know whether they're public. Damon would have to help me with that. But a number of countries have come to talk to us about it. Nobody has stepped up and said, yeah, we want the airplane today. A lot of people have talked about the cost of the aircraft. If they have one complaint, it is cost. So we've got that message. However, everybody is very, very taken by the capability. And I think the more these other folks operate with it in theater, the more they see of the capability of the aircraft and the more they covet it, and I think that's an advantage, but I still think cost is going to be the driver.
Can I follow up on what you said about the Navy birds? You said you're not sure they're going to go to the Navy.
Well, yeah, I don't know how that's going. There's been 48 airplanes for the Navy for a long time, but if you go look at the budget, there is no 48 aircraft in the budget for Navy aircraft, so they may be reallocated somehow. So the program of record is still 458, but we just don't know how they're going to get allocated.
And you don't have any idea where they would be able to pass off in the Marines?
Well, they could. We're not privy to that information. But the program of record still is 458 aircraft.
Yes, sir. Jim Winchester, Air International. The AH-6I, is there a U.S. Army Special Forces requirement to either have a new aircraft like that or rebuild older AH-6s?
Not today. However, we do have some technology improvements that we're doing in conjunction with the special operations folks, and I can't talk about what they are. Hopefully, eventually, when they see the benefits that we're getting from the AH-6I, that will be something they look at as they decide either to select the fleet or, you know, go to their next configuration. But there is nothing, there is no program with them yet. We obviously talk to them about our capability, but there is nothing I can report other than what I've told you.
Tony Skinner from Defence Helicopter. Can you talk a little bit more about the consortium?
Yeah.
And, you know, in practical terms, how it's going to work, when it's going to be up and running?
Well, it should be up and running soon, I hope. We signed everything, I think it was last week. So, you know, this isn't just the OEMs in the U.S. This is, they're U.S. companies. So the U.S. side of Gustav Westens, for example, is part of the consortium. EADS North America is part of the consortium. Universities, anybody who believes that they work in the helicopter industry, not helicopter, let me correct myself, vertical lift industry. So Lockheed Martin, for example, are part of this. So it's not just rotorcraft focused, it's vertical lift focused. Even though obviously what we're trying to do is push the rotorcraft side of this, because I think everybody believes, you know, we need some inertia and some acceleration of that inertia inside our business. So now the point is that what we're trying to do is drive innovation into the business, and we will pull together a board that will work with the government, that will represent all of the people that I've just said, to talk about in phase one what the roadmaps are for the way ahead for the rotorcraft industry, and that will be controlled by the DoD. But there will be a strong relationship between them and us, and they will work with us on how we develop the rotorcraft industry in the future from an S&T perspective and an R&D perspective. So I don't know how they're going to pull all of that together inside DoD, but I'm sure they are thinking about how they gather all their funding up and focus it in the right areas when it comes to rotorcraft and other vertical lift.
So DoD,
yeah. S&T
money could be pushed into
the consortium? Yeah, I mean, I think they already have S&T money. I think my belief is there's going to be a tendency to try and focus that through one area. So remember, this isn't all about the OEMs now. This is about the industry. So it's not about Boeing, it's not about Sikorsky, it's about the industry as a whole and reinvigorating the industry so that in the future, we're not dealing with aircraft that are still probably 1970s and 80s aircraft. We're pushing the technology forward that are going to allow us to give the warfighter a better product in 2025. And it's a joint thing.
Any last questions?
Yep. Paul Jackson, Show News again. Back to AH6, if I may. Do you have a figure for how many orders you need before you're prepared to launch?
Yep.
May I ask a second question?
You can ask it whether you get an answer or not.
Fair enough. I won't waste the mic.
But we do have a number, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we've done all the math. We know how to fund it and all the rest of it. We've done all of that work, but I can't tell you what it is.
And that will be at MESA?
Oh, yes.
Okay, thank you.